Hello and welcome to the Talking News for St Albans, Harpenden and the surrounding area. I'm Bill. This is the Red Saturn programme for Saturday, March 22nd, 2025. I do hope you're all well and enjoying what appears to be spring in the air. Following a request from one of our listeners to hear something by Glenn Miller, I'm opening today's show with his most famous piece, In the Mood. Later in the programme, you'll be able to hear more Glenn Miller and learn a bit about his life too, courtesy of local maestro David Arson. If other listeners have a favourite song or piece they'd like to hear on the programme, please send your request in the red pack with the USB drive when you return it, and I'll do my best to track it down and play it. This week, as always, we start off with the news stories from the Hearts Advertiser. This will be followed by the radio listings and audio-described TV listings. 10 Today is up next, our series of gentle exercise routines to help keep you moving at home. Then we have a number of events this week in history, which will be followed by some famous birthdays. Then I'll hand over to David Arison, who will tell you more about Glenn Miller and his music. Sounds of Nature, provided to us by the Wildlife Sound Recording Society, is next, where Clive Davis tracks his local amphibians. Following on from this will be a remarkable story from the Hearts Life Archive about Dr. Thomas Dimmesdale, a Hearts-based physician who treated Russia's Catherine the Great for smallpox. We start with the news, and our readers this week are Lucy, Ian, Hilary and Gilly.
Hello, this is Hilary. Family mourn motorcyclist killed in crash. The family of a motorcyclist who was killed in a road traffic collision near Caddington has issued a tribute to him. Bobby Smith, 29, from Markgate, died at the scene of the incident on the A5183 Watling Street at around 5:40 a.m. on Monday, March the 3rd. Emergency services attended, but were unable to save him. His family have issued a statement reading, "Bobby was more than a brother. He was a source of love, kindness and unwavering dedication to those he held dear. A beloved uncle, friend and colleague, he touched the lives of many with his quiet strength and selfless heart. Bobby lived for his family, his work and his dogs, pouring his energy into the things and people that mattered most to him. He was hard-working and humble, never seeking recognition but always giving his best. His presence was irreplaceable, and now, in his absence, we feel a void that words cannot fill. The world was not always kind to him, yet he remained pure and innocent, carrying a heart of gold despite its hardships. He gave love freely and asked for little in return. His loss is a tragedy that will forever impact our family, changing us in ways we never imagined. Though he is no longer with us, Bobby's love, kindness and the memories we shared will live on in our hearts. We will miss him always and honour him by carrying forward the love and strength he showed us every day. Fly high, our brother. You will never be forgotten." A man in his 40s was arrested on suspicion of causing death by dangerous driving and has since been bailed pending further inquiries. Anyone with information can report to Bedfordshire Police online, quoting Operation Robinson.
Hello, this is Lucy, and it's great to be reading for you on a beautiful spring day. And the first article today is all about Eva Hewitt, founder of EH Permanent Makeup, who has been voted a finalist in two UK beauty competitions. She's in the running for Best for Brows at the UK Hair and Beauty Awards 2025 and Semi-Permanent Artist of the Year 2025 at the GB Beauty Awards. This accomplishment is a dream come true for Eva, who will go head to head with some of the industry's best at these awards. Beginning her career as a dental nurse, Eva had a passion for art and sought a career that combined creativity and helping people. 3 years ago, Eva trained with one of the best permanent makeup trainers in the UK, marking her entry into the beauty sector. Eva said, "A good pair of eyebrows can make such a difference to a person's appearance and confidence. Many women experience thinning brows as they age, and I love being able to restore their brows in a natural, flattering way. Seeing the smile on my clients' faces after their transformation is truly priceless." Eva's salon, EH Permanent Makeup, offers one-on-one personalised treatments, and since opening her home-based studio in St Albans a year ago, Eva has built a strong reputation with more than 100 five-star Google reviews. She also offers tattoo laser removal, skin microneedling, and other skin rejuvenation treatments. Eva continues to invest in her education and regularly attends masterclasses across the UK and abroad to improve her skills. The UK Hair and Beauty Awards finals will take place on August the 30th in Birmingham, while the GB Beauty Awards winners will be announced in September. Eva added, "I am beyond excited and so proud to be a finalist. Representing St Albans in these national competitions is an honour, and I hope to bring home the win." EH Permanent Makeup Salon is open Monday to Saturday. More details can be found on her website, and you can also find her on social media under the name EH Permanent Makeup.
Hello, I'm Ian. Decision Day is looming for a planning application to build up to 150 new homes on land in St Albans. Plans, submitted by Carla Homes, Chiltern Limited, would see land to the rear of 113 to 156B Harpenden Road become a large housing development. The proposal currently consists of 124 houses, 30% of which would be affordable. There will be 17 one-bedroom, 15 two-bedroom, 42 three-bedroom, 36 four-bedroom, and 13 five-bedroom houses on the plot. One further affordable dwelling has been added to the amended plans. A central open space will feature in the middle of the development, and houses will be surrounded by a green edge. Associated garages, parking, and landscaping works are also included in the application, with new vehicular and pedestrian access to be built on the site of 156 Harpenden Road. The site earmarked comprises 5.24 hectares of metropolitan greenbelt and has been subject to plan since 2021. A decision is set to be made on the plans at a meeting of St Albans City and District Council's Development Management Committee tomorrow, March the 19th. This comes after the application was called in due to its significant scale and district-wide implications. It has been recommended that the committee grant conditional permission. Explaining more about the plans, the application reads, "The proposal has been carefully designed to comply with the broad requirements of the master plan and approved parameter plans in terms of land use, structure density, etc. It delivers a scheme which draws on its local context, echoing both the suburban 1930s character of the neighbouring residential development and that of the surrounding agricultural land, while delivering a coherent, attractive and verdant environment with a clear sense of place, set around open vistas." More than 30 objections were made during a public consultation. Popular concerns included increased congestion in an already high traffic area and potential issues with flooding. One user said, "The damage caused will be irreversible and have a devastating effect on the local community and wildlife on and surrounding Harpenden Road and New Greens."
Hello, I'm Gilly. Officers recover lost engagement ring. Officers were put through the ringer, tasked with finding a lost engagement ring during an evening patrol in Harpenden. Members of the force were caught up in two incidents last week, demonstrating why no two police jobs are the same. Sergeant Hammond and PC Bowles assisted an incident where an alleged drink driver assaulted an emergency worker on Luton Road, Harpenden. While clearing up, the officers were approached by a member of public who had misplaced a diamond engagement ring. According to police, she believed she had emptied it into a bin by mistake. The pair stepped forward to assist the female by digging through surrounding bins and searching the immediate area in hope of locating the ring. After an extensive search of the area, the officers found the ring and returned it to its owner. And there's a lovely picture of Sergeant Hammond and PC Bowles reunited a woman and her engagement ring in Harpenden.
7-year-old girl smashes a world record. With 92 star jumps in 1 minute, a primary school pupil has blown past the world record for the most completed in 1 minute. Sienna Simmons discovered her hidden talent when she came top of her class, completing as many star jumps as possible in 2 minutes during a PE competition at Manor Lodge School in Shenley. Realising quite how fast she was, her dad, Paul Simmons, decided to find out whether there was a score to beat. During a quick test run against the most star jumps in 1 minute under 16's Guinness World Record of 65, the Radlett 7-year-old completely blew it out of the water and so began getting ready for the official attempt on February the 21st. After Guinness World Record assessors scrutinised the footage, it was confirmed that she had completed 27 more jumps than the previous record holder and secured her place in the record books. "I love being active and pushing myself to do my best," Sienna said. "I never imagined I'd break a world record, but I'm so happy I did it." Despite the amazing achievement, her family say it is just on to the next thing for Sienna, who has stayed humble and doesn't really like to talk about it, but hopes it inspires other kids to take on big challenges. She has been apparently always interested in healthy living and eating, but did not require any specific training to beat the previous record. "I've never met anyone in my life who is a world record holder, so to have one in our family, we are so proud of her," her dad said. "I can't believe that we know someone who is actually a world record holder. She should be really proud of herself for achieving it." Manor Lodge School head teacher Alison Lobo said, "Sienna's accomplishment is inspiring to children to stay active and dream big. Proof that with focus and enthusiasm, setting new records is possible."
The second article today is titled "Manager Explains Difficult Pub Exit." The general manager of the White Lion has expressed his disappointment at leaving the pub due to difficult negotiations. The Sopwell Lane venue closed on March the 17th for a complete makeover of the pub and team. Former general manager Eric Vilgus, 45, is broken to be stepping down after 3.5 years of hard work. He said discussions with brewery Punch Pubs & Co. were like talking to a brick wall, and accused the company of turning the pub in the opposite direction. "I've been trying to extend for another 5 years, but I feel as though I've been forced to leave," Eric said. "I stand by fresh ingredients, but the concept they offered was all frozen. After 27 years in hospitality, I can't do that. The pub would collapse." The 45-year-old also believed that the craft beer offering would drop to low-range lagers. A Punch spokesperson confirmed the pub was due to close on March the 17th for a refurbishment. The franchisee mentioned that they have enjoyed a great working relationship and remain in positive communication with the outgoing publican who employs Eric. "We would like to thank them for their hard work and dedication throughout their tenure," the spokesperson added. "The existing team will be transferring to join our new management partners, who are excited to meet the community and ensure that this fantastic, much-loved pub continues to thrive, providing an outstanding guest experience, offering great drink, entertainment and a menu of high-quality, fresh and seasonal dishes that the community can enjoy for many years to come. The company aims to have the pub back open and trading in April."
St Albans holidaymaker escapes Egyptian diving boat blaze. St Albans diving fanatic and his best friend have recalled their escape from a boating blaze while on holiday in Egypt. Jeremy Brooks, 67, has lived with his wife in St. Albans for more than 30 years. His passion for diving has taken him across the world, most recently to Egypt's famous Port Ghalib. The psychotherapist had travelled with his friend Keith Shepherd, 69, to spend a week diving in the Red Sea courtesy of Emperor Divers. A largely uninterrupted trip featured fantastic coral reefs, sunbathing and sharks until the final day. On March the 13th, the pair were suddenly awoken at 6:30 a.m. to banging and an alarm. "Luckily, we were in port and not at sea, so everyone quickly ran off the gangplank," Jeremy began. "We saw some smoke coming from the engine, but were hopeful it was nothing. But it wouldn't go out, and flames kept coming out. Within 15 minutes, the whole boat was engulfed, filled with pressurized air tanks that Jeremy said exploded like bombs." He continued, "Once the crew realizes it was out of control, we had to leg it. Tanks started exploding, and it drifted into the sea. All the other boats were desperately trying to get out of the way. The fellow travellers looked on in fear as the boat continued to burn, and Jeremy suffered a sudden realization of all the items he lost. Jeremy said, "You're watching it all unfold, and my first thought was hoping the crew got off okay. When everyone had left the boat, I realized my belongings were gone. There's all these sentimental items I'll never see again." Jeremy was fortunate to have his mobile phone, whilst others had lost keys, documents, and all forms of communication. Worst of all, everyone's passports had gone up in smoke, he added. Keith had left his glasses and phone. He couldn't see all the documents we had to fill out for our new temporary passports. I became his admin. Keith managed to communicate with his family by emailing his daughter's school to assure them he was okay. The duo were left stranded in Egypt for 5 more days, working with Emperor to obtain new documents to fly home. Jeremy praised the efforts of the dive company, who put pressure on the British consulate and compensated all of its customers with new clothes and reparations. Despite this, the 67-year-old will have to spend £5,000 to replace his expensive diving kit. Emperor Divers released a statement shortly after the fire was first reported. In the early hours of Thursday, March the 13th, Emperor Seven Seas was moored in Port Ghalib when a fire broke out that could unfortunately not be contained. Emperor Divers are very grateful to our dedicated and professional crew who, along with the guests on board, executed emergency procedures which ensured everyone was evacuated from the vessel unharmed. The situation is under control, and all clients and crew are safely ashore in Port Ghalib, where the Emperor Divers ground team are assisting with their needs. Jeremy said his attitude to diving will not change. However, he will take something to store his valuables. "I'm going to keep diving, but I'll keep a little bag next to my bed with anything valuable in. I don't want to be left high and dry again. What doesn't kill you makes you stronger. It's a scary experience, one I don't wish to repeat. But thankfully, it didn't happen at sea."
Town Cafe offers free parking to customers. A popular Harpenden cafe is now offering free parking after fares were implemented across the town. Customers at Silver Pallet will have their parking covered in a new initiative to give back. The eatery launched the campaign in response to new parking fares introduced by the district council. An Instagram post announced the news. It read, "Great food, great company, and now free parking. As a thank you to our amazing customers, we're covering your parking when you dine with us," the post added, "because good times should come with no extra cost." In February, more than 243 bays in Harpenden and an additional 70 in St. Albans were subject to new charges. The decision has faced significant backlash, with businesses like Stevenson's blaming its Harpenden closure on the fares. Parking tariffs, introduced in February, apply from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. in Harpenden, charging users £1.25 for a 1-hour stay and £3.75 for 2 hours. These cover a maximum stay of 2 hours with no return for 2 hours. One aim of the proposals is to encourage active travel, such as cycling and walking, where possible, rather than car use, to improve the environment. Another goal is to ensure a greater turnover of premium parking places and improve enforcement by enabling new methods such as ANPR, automatic number plate recognition.
Veterinary chain's plans for vacant unit. Plans for a new veterinary chain to move into the former St Albans Cotswold unit have entered consultation. Creature Comforts aims to open its first branch outside of London at the vacant Victoria Street space. A new application by HLP UK Limited on behalf of Creature Comforts features new Louvre grills at the front of the store and window glazing. Additionally, the frontage will change colour to a light purple in accordance with the company's branding. In 2023, the building at 91-93 Victoria Street was demolished to make way for a three-storey residential structure. A ground floor commercial unit was also included in the plans, which has remained vacant while works continue. Potential floor plans for the vets show the layout of the practice, including a reception, dental theatre and lab, and multiple consultation rooms. A kennel, x-ray rooms, wards and pharmacy also feature in the proposal. Plans are currently under public consultation until April the 5th, 2025.
Next up, a popular St Albans brunch spot is set to take over the cafe at Smallford Farm Shop. Hatch has announced the eatery will be opening a new location in Hertfordshire. A statement on its website confirmed the exciting partnership. Working alongside their fantastic shop and using produce from Glinwell next door, this is a partnership we are very excited to share with you, the statement read. Hatch confirmed that Favourites will be returning to the new menu, accompanied by dishes unique to Smallford. The new location will be launching by late March and serve more than 70 covers using a walk-ins only policy. It will also offer free parking and be dog friendly. Smallford Farm Shop followed up with its own confirmation, saying it was thrilled to announce the permanent takeover. After growing in popularity, Hatch opened its flagship site at Christopher Place in 2023. At the time, owner Chris Evans told the Hearts Advertiser, "The main reason for the move is that we have outgrown our old site on Holywell Hill. The second reason is that a bigger site allows us to be the brand that we've always wanted to be and do the things that we set out to do, but have been unable to do because we've been limited by space."
Appeal launched to identify man killed near St Albans Station 30 years ago. An appeal has been launched in an effort to finally identify a man who was struck and killed by a train near St Albans Railway Station almost 30 years ago. The unknown man died on Wednesday, August the 2nd, 1995, close to the station. Police inquiries at the time and in subsequent years failed to identify him. The British Transport Police has now launched a fresh appeal in the hope of finding out who he was. He is described as white, thin build, aged between 30 and 40, about 5'9" in height, with short, dark, curly brown hair, blue eyes and a large, pointy nose. He had a scar above his right eye and a distinctive tattoo on his right forearm depicting two birds, believed to be swallows, with a banner and the name Maria or Morena. A British Transport Police spokesman said, "British Transport Police are reinvestigating a number of non-suspicious deaths across the railway network where the deceased persons have never been identified. There was nothing suspicious in any of these deaths, but, despite significant inquiries at the time, their identities remain unconfirmed. It is hoped that if these new inquiries are successful, the next of kin may be traced, which will allow their families and friends to have some closure with regards to their disappearance." Visit mipp.police.uk/operation/93010202024B02-BP PO9 for more.
New rector welcomed by churches. A former head teacher and BBC Radio 2 contributor has been installed as a rector. St Nicholas Church in Harpenden was packed on Sunday for the Reverend Patrick Moriarty's induction as rector. Around 400 people, with more joining via a Facebook live stream, were present to welcome him, including Harpenden Mayor Pip Liver and MP Victoria Collins. In his new role, Reverend Moriarty will oversee St Nicholas, St Mary's and All Saints churches. He said, "My family and I were touched by the greeting we received on Sunday. Harpenden is such a fantastic town and I'm excited to meet the people and explore my new home. St Nicholas's, St Mary's and All Saints are a huge part of community life in Harpenden and we're looking forward to becoming a full part of that." Reverend Moriarty has been a priest since 2018, alongside a career in education, and succeeds Reverend Canon Dennis Stamps. He also regularly contributes to BBC Radio 2's Pause for Thought. And there's a really nice picture of him at his induction as rector.
Landlady announces she's leaving Village Pub with a heavy heart. Amid Harris Hawke attacks and national media attention, Flamsteed is losing a landlady at one of its three village pubs. After reopening the Three Blackbirds in June 2023, publican Rebecca Levine is set to step down as head of the pub. On Friday morning, Rebecca announced with a heavy heart that she would be leaving at the end of the month. "I have to announce the Three Blackbirds will be closing under my regime at the end of the month," an Instagram post read. "There really isn't anything to say except a huge thank you. The unwavering support has been incredible, and I've had the absolute privilege of meeting some of the most wonderful people in this pub and village, both sides of the bar, as the little 3BB family has grown." Jokingly, she added, "There's a bit of time left to say goodbye, raise a glass of Savvy B, and get rid of the hawk." Rebecca invited punters to pop in during the next couple of weeks and watch this space for the next harebrained idea. Stonegate said it was looking to recruit a new publican last week after a listing was published on the company's website. The listing described the pub as well-presented, rustic yet modern, with plenty of character. It is not yet confirmed if a new tenant has been found or if the pub will close. Stonegate has been contacted for further comment.
The next article is written by Cheryl Luze from St Albans Chamber of Commerce, and it's all about the importance of International Women's Day. This year's theme, Accelerate Action, highlights the urgency of advancing women's rights and bringing about change. This global event has been celebrated since 1911 and serves as a platform for recognising women's achievements and advocating for gender equality. Despite progress, gender inequality remains a pressing issue in the United Kingdom, and recent data reveals that women continue to face significant challenges in the workplace. The UK has slipped from 17th to 18th place in PwC's Women in Work Index, marking its lowest ranking in over a decade. This decline is attributed to a sluggish approach in addressing the gender pay gap and declining employment levels for women. Moreover, women still hold fewer than 10 CEO positions within FTSE 100 companies, highlighting the underrepresentation of women in top corporate roles. The Accelerate Action theme for IWD 2025 emphasises the need for swift and decisive measures to achieve gender equity. At the current rate, it's projected that full gender parity will not be achieved until 2158. That's approximately five generations from now. The IWD theme calls for increased momentum in dismantling systemic barriers and biases that hinder women's progress in both our personal and professional lives. In St Albans this month, the Chamber of Commerce hosted an inspiring IWD luncheon to commemorate this significant day. The event featured keynote speaker Dr. Emily Thompson, a renowned advocate for women's leadership and empowerment. Dr. Thompson shared her journey of overcoming obstacles in the corporate world and emphasised the importance of mentorship and resilience. Her insights resonated deeply with attendees, leaving them motivated to champion gender equality within their own organisations. A common question arises every year. Why don't we have an International Men's Day? International Men's Day is observed annually on November the 19th, and this day focuses on promoting positive aspects of male identity, facilitating dialogue on men's health, and challenging harmful masculine norms. It serves as a reminder that men, like women, should have the freedom to define their identities without being confined to traditional stereotypes. The significance of International Women's Day extends beyond celebration. It needs to serve as a call to action to address ongoing inequalities. In the UK, the gender pay gap remains a critical issue. Women are underrepresented in leadership positions, holding less than 10 CEO roles within FTSE 100 companies. And additionally, women are more likely to face career interruptions due to caregiving responsibilities, which can impact their long-term earnings and career progression. As the president of the St Albans Chamber of Commerce, I am proud of our community's commitment to these ideals. And our recent IWD lunch not only celebrated the achievements of women, but also reinforced our dedication to fostering an inclusive environment where both women and men can succeed without limitations and where we can make gender equity a reality.
Campaigner praises speed limit changes. County Council to monitor impact of reduction. A campaigner has praised speed limit changes on the A5183 Redbourne Road after his family suffered a life-changing crash. Harts County Council, HCC, has announced a speed limit decrease to improve driver behaviour and safety. On Friday, March the 14th, changes to speed restrictions on the busy A Road were implemented, after a consultation which saw 77% of respondents in favour of the proposed shifts. The aim of the scheme is to help residents understand how the road should be used safely. Providing a consistent speed limit is thought to improve driver behaviour and address issues including inappropriate overtaking or tailgating and speeding. Furthermore, it is hoped that the changes will reduce the number of collisions and improve safety. The section, which is national speed limit, 60 miles per hour, on the south end of the road, will be reduced to 50 miles per hour, and there will also be some changes to the speed limits at the Redbourne end. One resident in support of the restrictions changing is Mark from Redbourne, whose partner and children were involved in a devastating crash on the A5183 in 2020. Mark began, "I have witnessed irresponsible drivers dangerously overtaking and driving too fast on this stretch of road, with no consideration for other road users and those of us following the rules. My partner was on the way home from the school run with our two young children when a dangerous driver collided head-on with her car. It's had a devastating impact on our lives, and her ability to live life normally has been altered forever." The campaigner was pleased to see the County Council and other residents in support of the changes. A reduction of 10 miles per hour might delay an individual for a few seconds on their journey, but if it could save someone's life and stop another family going through what we've gone through, then it would be worth it, he said. Phil Bibby, Executive Member for Highways and Transport at HCC, said they have listened to residents when implementing the changes and hopes to see drivers using the road more responsibly. "We will monitor the impact the speed changes have and will consider if there are any other measures that need to be taken to make the route even safer," he added.
September's heavy rainfall led to 61 flooded homes. A 200% spike in rainfall last September led to 61 internally flooded properties in Harts, a report revealed. Hitchin was the worst affected district during the September rains, with 35 properties reported with internal flooding and a further 52 with external floods. The next worst affected area was St Albans, with 7 internally flooded homes and 16 externally flooded properties. The figures were seen by the County Council's Environment Cabinet Panel on Friday, March the 7th, as it explored the county's Flooding Responses and Challenges report. The report cited a number of mitigating measures carried out by the local authority to reduce flooding, but it highlighted that there are difficulties implementing them countrywide. It stated, "Landowners play an important role in influencing flood risk. However, the challenge remains that industry partners have no enforcement powers over landowners. Therefore, there is no requirement for landowners to implement mitigation measures to reduce surface water flow coming off their land as long as it follows the natural topography. This can impact on not only properties, but the surface water, foul and highway drainage, as they have not been designed to cope with water from these sources." The report added Hertfordshire had 200% more rainfall than the long-term average last September.
BBC presenter races through Hearts on first leg of Epic Comic Relief Challenge. BBC Radio 1's Jamie Lang completed the first leg of his ultramarathon for Comic Relief after running through Hertfordshire. The TV personality set off on his endurance test on Monday morning, racing across the county on his 150-mile, 5-day stretch to Salford. From Monday, March the 17th to Friday, March the 21st, Jamie will attempt to run across England ahead of Red Nose Day's Night of TV. Day one saw him navigate through the busy streets of London, heading north toward Harpenden, passing through Boreham Wood, Radlett and St Albans. After reaching the finish line in Harpenden, Jamie told the BBC, "I'm exhausted. I'm so tired. It's so far. It's really far. It's a long way. We're not in London anymore. We're in Harpenden. It's 100% harder than I thought it was going to be. I thought it was going to be hard. It's 100% harder than that." He was surrounded by friends and family as he left BBC's new broadcasting house at around 8:30 a.m., including his wife, Sophie Habu, and fellow Radio 1 hosts Greg James and Charlie Hedges. Greg James set Jamie on his way with a special show on BBC One Breakfast, offering words of wisdom before sending him down to the start line. Jamie said, "Greg said something great to me. He said, 'Just let the adventure come to you.' And that's what I'm going to keep in my mind throughout today. I had the honour of seeing firsthand some of the great work that Comic Relief's funding provides recently when I met the amazing people at Empire Fighting Chance in Bristol. So know I'm doing this for them and so many others is really what's keeping me going. There's even some projects here this morning to see me off, which is amazing. I can't wait to meet even more along the route." The first stop on the 150-mile journey was Hyde Park, where a flash mob of runners who were dressed in Red Nose Day vests, bleach blonde wigs and Jamie Lang face masks joined him. Lookalikes include Radio 1 DJs Sam and Danny, as well as representatives from the running charity. The Made in Chelsea star will run through cities, towns and villages where Comic Relief-funded partners are providing essential support in communities. Felicity Halstead, CEO of Comic Relief-funded partner Good Work, said, "We're delighted to be here to support Jamie's Ultra Marathon Man Challenge, which will be raising funds for Comic Relief. As a funded partner ourselves, donations will make a huge difference to small organisations like Good Work, allowing us to empower more young people from low-income backgrounds to access great employment opportunities and set them up for success. It's a fantastic opportunity for our young people to visit the BBC today, and we're looking forward to cheering Jamie on now and throughout his challenge. The charity run will be broadcast on Radio 1 and BBC Sounds across the week, with video highlights on Radio 1's social channels."
In our next article, Harpenden and Berkhamsted MP Victoria Collins talks about the importance of the community having input into local plans. When it comes to planning, I firmly believe in the principle that communities know best to get the right homes in the right places with the right infrastructure. But sadly, the continued top-down approach from Labour with a green light for developers shows this principle does not underlie our current national planning system. The scale of the speculative development on Greenbelt land in northwest Harpenden shows why it's so important to change this. Fundamentally, the government and its Conservative predecessors have failed to recognise the importance of community input into planning, bringing us where we are today. Both have set top-down targets from Whitehall rather than letting decisions be driven by communities who know what their area needs. And as a result, it's local residents who'll lose out, as I've made clear to the government. Whether it's the watering down of Greenbelt to Greybelt by the current government, the lack of protection against speculative development, and a lack of necessary mechanisms to ensure infrastructure first, it's these situations that listening to local voices can avoid. All things I've called ministers out on since being elected. In particular, I recently appealed to the Deputy Prime Minister to let our local council use their draft local plan. That has gone through consultation with local stakeholders to immediately shield our local area from speculative applications and for the plan to be given more weight. As it stands, our area remains unprotected until the local plan is approved, leaving us in limbo. This latest development's approval shows why this is needed. In the draft plan, this site was earmarked for just under 300 houses, but now local councils are powerless to push back while the local plan is being considered. Developers can therefore get approval for the 550 homes they've proposed, a shocking increase which would impact our local infrastructure from roads to GPs. If community voices had been amplified and this power to use the draft plan as a shield had been granted, the outcome would have been different. I'll keep urging the government to recognise this. Something else on people's minds this week will, I'm sure, be the COVID-19 pandemic. Although it's been 5 years since it was declared and much has changed, our memory of it is still fresh, and many people will still be feeling the loss of those who tragically lost their lives during it. Sunday, March the 9th, marked the COVID-19 Day of Reflection in memory of these individuals. This week is a time to commemorate them.
Anti-Elon Musk protest targets Tesla dealership. Protesters have targeted a Tesla dealership in St. Albans with anti-Elon Musk posters. A group calling itself Overthrow Musk shared a video of members taping the posters to the outside of Tesla Center St. Albans in Leon Way off Hatfield Road on March the 14th. In the social media clip shared to TikTok and Instagram, a group of people can be seen walking up to the showroom and attaching a message that says, "Welcome to Tesla St. Albans," above an image of the firm's CEO Elon Musk's straight-arm salute from American President Donald Trump's inauguration. This is continued, "Your local swastika showroom," on another poster showing the same image reversed on the other side of the door. A woman who appears to be a member of staff is then shown, with her face blurred, walking up to the store and taking a photo of the posters before text saying, "Bring down Musk," is displayed. Another video showing the building with the posters attached was captioned, "Overthrow Musk, just paid Tesla St. Albans a visit." It came on the same day protesters gathered outside a Tesla dealership in Park Royal, West London, to call for a boycott of the company. The electric car giant has already seen shares plunge since the start of the year, as the firm comes under pressure from Chinese rivals amid calls for a boycott over Musk's close ties with US President Donald Trump and far-right causes. Responding to claims the gesture was a Nazi salute, Mr. Musk posted on the platform he owns, X, formerly Twitter, this week, "Frankly, they need better dirty tricks. The everyone is Hitler attack is so tired." And the item is accompanied by a picture of the gentleman in question with his alleged Nazi salute.
MP on list of top 100 women in politics. Daisy Cooper MP has been named as one of the 100 leading women in politics and public service for the second consecutive year. The annual Women in Westminster, the 100 list, published by the House magazine, recognises the achievements of 100 influential women over the past year. The announcement, made shortly after International Women's Day on March the 8th, celebrates the work of these women in public life. St Albans MP Miss Cooper said, "It's really humbling, but also a real honour to feature in this list alongside so many other women leaders shaping political and public life. The list itself is a real tribute to all those trailblazers who broke down barriers and led the way for women in public life." And there's a picture of Daisy Cooper at the launch of the Women in Westminster, the 100 list.
Secondary school to welcome all genders. A St Albans secondary school is set to welcome students of all genders from September 2026. The Board of Governors at St Albans School have made the unanimous decision to allow all genders to join from Year 7. Co-educational provision will extend across the entire school from Year 7 through to sixth form, with both girls and boys being admitted into the first form from autumn next year. A statement said the school will be building on its strong tradition, core values and commitment to educational excellence. The strategic decision is thought to underpin the school's vision of ensuring that every student flourishes intellectually and personally to find meaning and purpose in life. All transitions will be carefully managed by the school as it moves towards becoming a fully co-educational setting. Neil Osborne, chairman of the Board of Governors at St Albans School, said, "Having enjoyed great success in our co-educational sixth form over the last 30 years, the decision made by the Board of Governors to extend that provision across the whole school was unanimous. To thrive in this evolving landscape, our students must develop the interpersonal skills needed to collaborate, communicate, and succeed together. A truly modern education must reflect the future world and diverse society it prepares young people for, and that means learning side by side." Jo Sylvester, headteacher at St Albans School, added, "It's a privilege to be part of this remarkable community. The transition toward becoming fully co-educational is reflective of a school that never stands still. In fact, the decision allows the school to move from a position of strength with great confidence and ambition. We strive to educate our students about the wider world and what it means to become a purposeful and ambitious individual who makes a valuable contribution to society. I'm absolutely committed to making this accessible to all. It is precisely because of our vision and values that now is the right time to complete the co-educational journey that began over 30 years ago in 1991, when girls were first admitted to the sixth form."
Our final article today is all about students at a Harpenden secondary school who are given the opportunity to meet professionals in the creative media industry. St John Laws School hosted its inaugural SJL Nexus networking event last Thursday, which aimed to be a unique opportunity for students to connect with professionals to gain insight into the industry. Guest speakers at the event included Rob Spink, Vice President of Business Insights, International Digital Distribution at NBC Universal, Pos Watson, freelance screenwriter for BBC's Casualty, Eloise Phillips, Partnership Delivery Account Manager at Global, and Emma Daly, Publicity Manager at ITV. The networking event had a carousel-style format, allowing students to engage in small group discussions with every guest speaker. Rob Spink said it was fantastic to see the level of enthusiasm and curiosity from the students at the SJL Nexus networking event. Their thoughtful questions and eagerness to learn made for an engaging and dynamic discussion, and I was honoured to be part of the conversation. Emma Daly added, "I was impressed by the enthusiasm and genuine interest from all of the students to hear about the future of this industry."
NF Soundings. Features from across the UK.
Now for a look at some of this coming week's radio highlights, starting with Saturday, March 22nd. The drama First Out by David Eldridge. With the arrival of the pandemic and the death of both their parents, identical twins who were barely on speaking terms are forced to confront their relationship. Radio 4, Saturday afternoon at 3. A programme from 2017, Five Screen Goddesses, this week focuses on Betty Davis. Radio 4 Extra on Saturday, 3:45pm or 9:45pm. And Classic FM at the Movies, presented by Jonathan Ross, features an in-depth conversation with Hollywood composer Hans Zimmer, whose work includes music for Gladiator and Dunkirk. Classic FM, 7 o'clock, Saturday night. Sunday, March 23rd, the castaway on Desert Island Discs this week is Donna Ockenden, the former midwife who went on to chair key reviews of maternity services in multiple hospitals. Radio 4, 10am. In his Life Stories, David Attenborough tells us more about the female duck-billed platypus in New South Wales. Radio 4 Extra, 11:45 Sunday morning or 5:45 in the evening. Michael Williams reads from the collection of letters by poet and broadcaster John Betjeman in the Betjeman Letters from 1995. Radio 4 Extra, again, 12:30 in the afternoon or 6:30 Sunday evening. Britain's shrinking army finds out why the British Army is dealing with failing recruitment at a crucial junction for the future of UK defence. Radio 4, 1:30, lunchtime on Sunday. You can hear an omnibus edition of the first five episodes of Vanity Fair, a dramatisation from 2004 of Thackeray's novel, starring Emma Fielding and narrated by Stephen Fry. Radio 4 Extra, 1:50 in the afternoon or 7:50. The next five episodes of this 20-part series can be heard at the same times Monday to Friday this week as well. And a reminder, we'll run through some of the other ideas for the rest of the week in a moment. Back to Sunday, though, March 23rd and Kramer versus Kramer, the first of a two-part dramatisation of Avery Corman's novel. Workaholic Ted is forced to rethink his priorities when his wife leaves, making him sole guardian of their five-year-old son. Radio 4, Sunday afternoon, 3 o'clock. Paul Gamachimi hosts the final of the music quiz Counterpoint on Radio 4 at 4:30, while from our own correspondent is on Radio 4 at 9:30pm. On to those programmes then that are broadcast at the same time every day from Monday to Friday, very similar to Vanity Fair that I was mentioning earlier. Book of the Week is Underdogs by economist journalist Joel Budd, offering a sharp corrective to the familiar stereotype of the white working class. Radio 4 all week, 11:45 in the morning, Monday to Friday. Iris is a reading from 1999 of John Bailey's memoir of his married life with novelist Iris Murdoch. Radio 4 Extra, every day, 8:30 in the morning, 1:30 at lunchtime, or 7:30pm, Monday to Friday. The series Human Intelligence, dissecting the minds of brilliant thinkers from the past, continues on Radio 4 at 1:45 all week. Composer of the week is Gustav Mahler. Radio 3, 4 o'clock, every day this week. New Generation Thinkers begins an eclectic series of 10 essays on a variety of subjects. On Monday, it begins with Technicolor Wars, exploring the politics of making films in colour. It's then continuing on Radio 3 at 9:45 every night this week, and actually next week as well. Lastly for this week, though, Book of Bedtime continues the reading of Twist by Colin McCann. Radio 4, 10:45pm, all week, Monday to Friday. On to the individual programmes, then, to listen to through the week, starting with Monday, March 24th. The Arts Exodus is a programme from 2016. Deborah Coughlin examines the value of art to communities and cities and the impact of gentrification in which artists are often priced out of areas they help to revitalise. Radio 4 Extra, 10:30 in the morning or 4:30 in the afternoon on Monday. Eel Conda is a dramatisation from 1994 of Joseph Conrad's 1908 short story. Radio 4 Extra, 3 o'clock on Monday or 9pm at night. And The Making of a Chancellor focuses on Rachel Reeves ahead of her spring statement. Laura Kunzberg speaks to senior policymakers, the Chancellor herself and those who know her. Radio 4, at 4 p.m. on Monday. Tuesday, March 25th, in Hamlet Undressed, Maxine Peake goes backstage at the Manchester Royal Exchange Theatre's 2014 production of Hamlet. Radio 4 Extra, 10:30 in the morning or 4:30 in the afternoon. Tuesday's drama is the first of three parts of Faith, Hope and Glory. Three generations of three families bound together by the fate of one baby lost and found on Tilbury Dock. Radio 4, 2:15 in the afternoon. In the Salon Al-Bahari, part of the series History's Secret Heroes, Helena Bonham Carter shines a light on two apprentice seamstresses who found an ingenious hiding place for their Jewish colleagues in wartime Sarajevo. Radio 4 on Tuesday afternoon, 3 o'clock. What's Up Docs, a new series in which identical twin doctors Chris and Zan van Tuchelen explore every aspect of health and being. They begin this week with How Important is Willpower? Radio 4, 4:30 p.m. And as it's a Tuesday, Peter White presents his regular programme In Touch, news and features for the blind and partially sighted, Radio 4, 8:40 p.m. Wednesday, March 26th. Phylon 4 Investigates looks into how our end-of-life tyres end up in India, processed through makeshift plants that are causing an environmental tragedy. Radio 4, 11 a.m. 1994 is the first episode of a futuristic sitcom from 1985, starring Robert Lindsay. Radio 4 Extra on Wednesday, 12 noon or 6 p.m. In the series Women Talking About Cars, Victoria Cora Mitchell talks motors with Claudia Winkleman. Radio 4 Extra, 1 o'clock at lunchtime or 7 p.m. Choral Evensong from the Church of St. Michael and All Angels in Barnes. Radio 3, 3 p.m. And I'm 16 Going on 60 tracks down the child stars of the film musical The Sound of Music, revealing what they've been doing since 1965. Radio 4, 3:30 p.m. on Wednesday. Thursday, March 27th, a new series of the sitcom Plum House, set at a country house and featuring Simon Callow and Jane Horrocks, among others. Radio 4 Extra, 8 in the morning, 1 o'clock lunchtime, 7 p.m. at night. In the last of the series, This Natural Life, Raina Wynne, author of The Salt Path, takes Martha Kearney back to Walk the Southwest Coast Path from Polrain in Cornwall. Radio 4, 3 o'clock. And the Today podcast brings us Amal Rajan and Nick Robinson's take on the biggest news stories of the week. Radio 4, 11 p.m. on Thursday. Finally, Friday, March 28th, in the series The Food Programme, When Saturday Comes, finds out how football clubs are upping their game when it comes to serving food for their fans. Radio 4, 11 a.m. In the series Why Do We Do That? Why Do We Dance? Studies people's tendency to dance or even tap along with when they hear music, and looks around the rest of the animal kingdom to find out whether other animals besides birds dance. Radio 4, Friday afternoon, 2:45. In Friday Night is Music Night, Katie Derham presents a concert of music evoking spring on Radio 3 at 7:30 p.m. We can but hope. And Americast offers insights and analysis on what's happening inside Trump's White House on Radio 4 at 11 p.m. Again, we can hope. That's it. Thank you to Wendy for the highlights this week. May I wish you a peaceful, safe and enjoyable one of radio listening.
Now for the audio described television programmes starting Saturday 22nd and ending Friday 28th of March, compiled by Sarah and read by Rebecca.
Starting with Saturday the 22nd. The comedy starts early on Channel 4 with back-to-back episodes of Everyone Loves Vet Raymond and then The Simpsons from 7:50 to 11:35. Over on BBC Two at 9:30, there's Stacey Solomon's Sort Your Life Out, when she prevents a family descending in messy chaos at home. If you prefer food programmes on Saturday morning, there's a head-to-head between TV chefs, Mary Berry at 11:30 on BBC One, or Prue Leith on ITV at 11:45. There's a couple of afternoon films on offer. The animated Trolls World Tour is on BBC One at 2:05, or The Big Sleep on BBC Two at 2:40. Over on Channel 4 in the afternoon, you can watch Grand Designs at 3:30. This week, a couple buy a derelict flour mill to restore in Cornwall. This is followed by a new series of the Great Celebrity Bake Off, Stand Up to Cancer, at 4:30, when various celebrities raise awareness of cancer whilst trying to produce a series of baked goods. On ITV at 5, Bradley Walsh hosts The Chase Celebrity Special, or for something more physical and quite frankly terrifying, tune in to BBC One at 10 to 6 for the semi-finals of Gladiators. Things calm down a bit on Channel 4 at 6:15 with the documentary series Titanic in Colour, when we learn more about the fated crew and ship. This is followed at 7:15 by Our Dream Farm with Matt Baker. Lambing is in full swing and the farm opens to welcome tourists. Continuing on Channel 4, Alice Roberts explores the origins of theatre in Ancient Greece by Train at 8:15. Whilst over on ITV at 8:20, there's the quiz show, The 1% Club, when 100 contestants could win up to £100,000. Casualty has its usual spot on BBC One at 8:25. This is followed by the Victorian drama Dope Girls, which explores the birth of the nightclub scene in London's Soho. There's three films on offer tonight. An action thriller, Plane, on Channel 4 at 9:15. Gerard Butler stars as an airline pilot who must become a one-man army after crash landing on an island overrun by bad guys. There's further action after this at 11:25 with The Transporter starring Jason Statham. For something a bit more light-hearted, head to BBC One at 10:30 for the romantic comedy The Proposal. Now for Sunday. At 11 on BBC Two, Andy Oliver visits her old neighbourhood of Notting Hill and makes her most fabulous feast yet to celebrate the work of the community. On ITV at 12:35, Prue Leithy's back in her Cotswold kitchen, and back on BBC Two at 1:45, it's Nadia's Simple Spices, when she shares Moorish money-saving recipes. BBC One offers us afternoon sun and fun at 1:35 with the musical film Mamma Mia. In the early evening, there's a choice across the channels. Tom Hanks continues to narrate the nature show The Americas on BBC One at 6:15. This week, we learn more about hidden stories from the Amazon rainforest. On BBC Two at 7:15, there's More Beautiful Nature in Expedition with Stephen Backshall, where he leads a group in the Jebel Akbar mountain range in Oman. The drama series 10 Pound Poms continues on BBC One at 8. This is followed at 9 by a gritty new drama series, This City Is Ours, when we meet Michael, who is steeped in crime but falls in love with Diana. For real-life drama at 9, Channel 4 have Tempting Fortune. Paddy McGuinness hosts as 12 people face temptation in the Malaysian jungle to win a share of £300,000. At the same time, over on ITV, there's another crime series, Protection. For something completely different, head over to BBC Two at 9 for a star-studded documentary, Ken Dodd, A Legacy of Happiness. Now for the programmes which are on at the same time, same channel, each weekday. On BBC One, there's Fraud Squad at 10:45, whilst later in the afternoon on BBC Two, there's Incredible Medicines at 3 each day. On Channel 4, there's Find It, Fix It, Flog It at 10 past 1. The regular soap operas are generally on at the usual time, with the exception of Monday, when there is live international football on ITV at 7. So the soaps are as follows. Monday, it's EastEnders, BBC One. Tuesday is an hour-long Emmerdale from 7, followed by Corrie at 8 and EastEnders at 7:30 over on BBC One. Wednesday is Emmerdale at 7:30 and Corrie at 8, both obviously on ITV. Thursday, it's Emmerdale at 7:30 and EastEnders at 7:30. And on Friday, you've another dose of drama with Emmerdale at 7:30, followed at 8 by Corrie's, both on ITV. We're moving on to Monday's programmes. So, in addition to the regular programmes already mentioned, you can watch the cooking show Batch from Scratch on Channel 4 at 8, which is followed at 9 with another episode of Tempting Fortune with Paddy McGuinness. BBC One are focusing on the pandemic with Love and Loss, the pandemic 5 years on. We meet people affected by this strange period in world history and learn that COVID claimed the lives of over 220,000 people, the biggest loss of life in the UK since the Second World War. For something less harrowing or more amusing, you can choose between The Detectorists on BBC Two at 10 or Celebrity Gogglebox on Channel 4, also at 10. Now on to Tuesday's options. Your evening options kick off with Mary Berry's Simple Comforts. This week, Mary makes delicious warming dishes in the Highlands. Stacey Solomon is again sorting out someone's life at 8 on BBC One. This week, it's a family whose household is overwhelmed by hobbies, including 112 board games and over 4,000 plastic toys. This is followed at 9 on BBC One by the high school-based drama Waterloo Road. Staying with the school theme, Channel 4 has the final episode of the series School Swap, UK to USA, when the UK youngsters grapple with the stress of finding a date for the prom. George Clark follows this at 9 with a new series of Amazing Spaces, when he meets a circus chef who turns two lorries into a travelling home. There's a couple of late evening films to choose from. The musical Mamma Mia is on ITV at 10:45, whilst on BBC Two at 11:05, there's Selma, based on the civil rights struggle in Alabama in 1965. Now on to Wednesday's viewings, which is as follows. The Repair Shop fills its usual slot on BBC One at 8. Amongst other items, the team repair a banner for a jazz band from the 1920s and a precious garden ornament. Also at 8, but over on Channel 4, there's Kirsty and Phil's Love It or List It. This week, they help a family who have devoted the last 14 years to fostering over 30 children. For more housey viewing, continue on Channel 4 for a new series of Grand Designs at 9. You've three other 9 o'clock slots to choose from, though. On BBC One, there's Rose Ailing Ellis's Old Hands New Tricks. Rose helps to teach sign language to a group of mature students in just 6 weeks. BBC Two have Surgeons on the Edge, and on ITV, it's the last part in the series A Cruel Love, the Ruth Ellis story. Ruth opens up to her lawyer about the full story of the 2 weeks leading up to David Blakely's murder. Now for Thursday. In addition to the somewhat limited daytime options, these are your evening choices. BBC One continues with Dragon's Den at 8, followed by The Apprentice at 9. This week, the candidates face a high-pressure TV shopping task when they must sell items live to the nation, as well as one special viewer watching at home. On ITV, there's The Doghouse, Lurcher Skye and Staffy Cross Leon hope to be chosen for rehoming. This is followed at 9 by 24 hours in A&E, when a trio of injured pedestrians are brought to Queen's Medical Centre in Nottingham after a car mounts the pavement. Fiona Bruce and Philip Mould investigate another potentially priceless work of art in Fake or Fortune on BBC Two at 9. And your final option this evening is a new two-part documentary on Channel 4 at 10. Kill List, Hunted by Putin's Spies. In this programme, we learn about the experiences of a man targeted by Bulgarians, recently convicted of spying for Russia. The second part follows immediately at 11:05. Finally, on to Friday. You can start your evening with the thought-provoking documentary series on Channel 4, Unreported World, this week focusing on France's far-right feminists. There's a new series of Beyond Paradise on BBC One at 8. This week, a body is found in the river in Devon. This is followed at 9 by the final episode in the series of the fictional crime in Death in Paradise. Over on BBC Two at 9, we can follow the recovery of broadcaster Clemency Burton Hill after she suffers a devastating brain hemorrhage in Mr. Brain After the Rupture. You have a couple of late night film options. Get Out on BBC One at 11:40. This is a horror mystery, or the spy-based drama Red Joan on BBC Two at 11:05. Well, we've got to the end of this week's ADTV listing. Hope you fancy something of interest.
ENF Soundings.
Hello everyone, this is 10 Today, a 10-minute set of exercises to do at home to help keep yourself active. Before we get to today's presenter, a couple of housekeeping points to note. The 10 Today project is funded by the Big Lottery and Sport England, and when you're doing the exercises, it's important that you don't push yourself too far, and by taking part, you agree to 10 Today's terms and conditions. You can read these terms and conditions at tnflink.uk/10T, and the 10T is the digit 1, the digit 0, and the letter T. And please remember that you agree to take part at your own risk. Today's exercises are brought to you by Mike, and here he is.
Hello everyone, and welcome to 10 Today. This is Series 2, Session 7. These are short 10-minute physical activity routines which will get you moving and stretching. They're great for your health, including boosting your mood. And very importantly, they're designed to support your everyday movements, your functional fitness, your flexibility, balance and mobility, such as when you have to reach up, turn, bend down and so on. These simple routines will help you with all that. Just take them at your own pace. There are plenty of options. And if an exercise feels too much, then just take it easy and have a break. All the exercises can be done either standing up or sitting down, so just do whatever feels good for you today. When lifting your arms or knees, only go as far as is comfortable. If you have any problems with your knees or hips, take care not to twist them during the movements. It can also help to pull in your tummy when you're bending your back, and just breathe normally throughout the activities. We want you all to enjoy these activities safely. You're responsible for monitoring how you're feeling throughout the sessions. If you feel any discomfort or pain, for example, if you'd feel unwell or dizzy, or experience palpitations, then please stop and seek medical advice. You agree to take part at your own risk. If you're remaining seated, it would be ideal if you can use a hard chair, preferably one without arms, such as a dining chair that you can sit upright in with a straight back and with your feet flat on the floor. If you're standing, just step your feet hip-width apart, relax your shoulders and take a good strong stance. And you might want to have a sturdy chair nearby to hold on to sometimes, just for balance. We hope you enjoy 10 Today. So, we're just going to start with a warm-up. You're just going to quickly tap or pat different parts of your body. So briefly tap along each arm, one at a time, in different places. Your upper arm, your forearm and your wrist. Do the same on both arms. Then pat the top of both legs, quickly tapping up and down your legs in various places towards your knees. Just for a few seconds. You should be nicely warmed up now and ready to move. Right, we're going to start with push away the water. So, in the usual starting position, with your feet hip-width apart and shoulders relaxed, hold your hands out directly in front of you at shoulder height, with your hands side by side, index fingers touching. Then just tilt your hands so that your palms are facing to the right, and sweep both arms out wide and towards the right, as if you're pushing away a torrent of water that's rushing towards you. Bring your arms back to the centre and then tilt them so your palms are facing left and sweep out wide in that direction, as far as comfortable. Keep going with those arms, sweeping them out to the right again, back to the centre and then to the left, pushing that water away. A few more times now. Try to keep your arms at shoulder height and sweep a little bit further back if you can. This is great for your arms, shoulders and chest. The next exercise is forward and low. Lift up your right leg, bending the knee towards your body. At the same time, lower your opposite elbow towards your raised knee. You don't have to touch it. Then return your foot to the floor and your arm to your side. And repeat with your left leg. So, raise the left leg up this time, lower your right elbow down towards your bent knee, and return your foot to the floor. If you can touch your knee with your elbow, that's great. Otherwise, just lower it as far as you can. Then keep going, alternating your feet and elbows a few more times, keeping it nice and low. Try and get your legs a bit higher if you can. This is great for your hip rotation, your back and your core. Now it's time for make headway. With this one, you're going to do a rowing action. So start by stepping your right foot forwards, leaning forwards and stretching both arms out in front of you with your palms down. Keep your arms a few inches apart and at shoulder height. Then make two loose fists as if you're reaching to grasp the oars and tighten the grip. Then, in one flowing movement, pull your arms back. Bring your upper body back and step back. Then step forward on your left foot as you lean forwards and stretch out your arms, gripping those oars again. Then pull your arms back, bringing your upper body back as you step back as well. Now, keep going with this, alternating your feet each time. If you're sitting, you can step your feet out to the side at an angle. If that's comfortable, to make it more challenging, just continue making the same flowing movement, pulling back a bit further if you can. This exercise is good for your arms and shoulders, as well as your back and core. Well done. So now it's feel the wind. Start by stepping your right foot forwards and stretch both arms out in front of you. You can lift the heel of your back foot slightly off the floor, shifting your weight to your toes as you move forwards. Open your arms out wide, reaching up and to each side to open your chest. Step your foot back as you lower your arms back down to your sides. It's a nice flowing movement with your arms, starting from the centre and then opening them up and out to the sides and back down. Now, swap feet, stepping forwards with your left foot this time and stretching both arms in front of you. Then opening your arms out wide and upwards again. Keep going for a few more times, just alternating your feet from left to right. You can try to sweep your arms a bit higher and a bit lower if you can. This is great for your arms, legs, shoulders, and balance. Now we're going to reach for the stars. Push both arms straight above your head and with your palms facing forwards. At the same time, rise up onto your toes. Then lower your arms and feet back down, bend forwards, and sweep both arms slowly from side to side in front of your legs. Then straighten up, arms back by your sides, and start again. So, raise both arms above your head and go up onto your toes. Lower your arms and feet, bend forwards, and swing those arms in front of your legs. First to the left, then to the right. And straighten back up again. Let's do a few more of these. Try reaching a bit higher and sweeping a bit lower if you can. This one is good for hand-eye coordination and also helps with your balance and your core. That's great. Well done. Next up, it's Strike of the Serpent. This is a martial arts type movement using the arms. So start by bending your elbows and raising your fists in front of your chest, as if you're about to start sparring. Then just punch your right arm out directly in front of you. Pull it back towards your body, then punch it out at an upwards angle this time, and pull it back. Now, change arms and punch out with your left fist. Pull your arm back and then punch out again at an upwards angle. Keep going, swapping those arms to punch your fist out to start with, pulling it back, and then angling it up with a punch. Keep going. And try putting more power into that punch if you can. That's really good. This one is great for your arms and shoulders and your hip movement too. This next one is called Defend the Flanks. So, in the usual start position with your feet hip-width apart and shoulders relaxed, turn your upper body to the right, keeping your feet facing forwards, and push both arms straight out in front of you with your palms facing forwards. Then pull your arms back towards your body, bending your elbows, palms still facing forwards, and your hands about level with your shoulders. Now, turn your upper body to the left and push those arms straight out again. Don't put too much tension on your knees. Keep going, turning from side to side and pushing your arms straight out and drawing them back in. So turn again to the right, both arms straight out and push. Then pull them back. Turn to the left, arms straight out and push. Just do a few more, turning from side to side. Try keeping your arms at shoulder height if you can. This exercise is a great one for your hip rotation, arms, shoulders, and wrists. Well done. Next up, it's floor to canopy. Lean forwards and lower both arms down towards your right leg, keeping your hands a few inches apart. Just go as low as is comfortable with a gentle bend in your knees. Then slowly swing your arms up, together and out wide to the right side, sweeping them in an arc or semicircle as you straighten up with your arms above your head. It's a nice fluid movement, so only hold your arms up briefly. Then bring them back down again on that same right-hand side, making that semicircle shape again, sweeping back towards your right leg. So, you're leaning forwards, lowering your arms down towards your right leg, sweeping them out wide and back up above your head, and then coming back down. Do a couple more on your right side. That's good. Now, we'll switch to the left and repeat the movement a few times on this side. Keep going. Try to reach a little bit higher and a little bit lower if you can. This is another great one for your arms, shoulders, and chest. Now, time for our last exercise for today. It's jumping jacks. You might remember jumping jacks from the playground, but happily our version is a little bit more sedate. Just stretch both arms straight out to each side, in line with your shoulders, and at the same time, reach your right foot forward, tapping your toe on the floor and lifting your heel slightly. Then step back and lower your arms back to your sides. Do exactly the same again, this time reaching forward with your left foot, tapping the toe and pointing your arms straight out to each side. Step back as you lower your arms. Just keep going for a few more times, alternating your foot from left to right, lifting those arms as you step forwards and lowering them as you step back. Try to keep your arms straight if you can. This exercise is really good for your balance and your core, as well as your legs and arms. And that's it. We're just going to finish with a quick shake to cool down. So raise both arms above your head towards the ceiling and just briefly wave your hands and arms in the air. Then lift one leg slightly from the floor if you can, shake it out in the air for a second or two, raise the other leg and shake that one out as well. Or you can just shake your upper body instead. And that's the end of today's 10 Today session. Great work, everyone. We hope you enjoyed it. Doing 10 Today just 3 times a week can have positive benefits for your physical health and improve your well-being too. It's short, it's fun, and you'll simply feel better. So do keep going.
TNS Soundings.
Hello, I'm David, and here are some historical events that took place this week in the past. On March the 23rd in 1840, the first successful photograph of the moon was taken by John William Draper in New York City. Draper, who was a scientist and a professor at New York University, used a daguerreotype camera to capture this groundbreaking image. The photograph was taken from the rooftop observatory of the university, marking a significant achievement in both astronomy and photography. This image was not only a technical marvel of its time, but also a testament to humanity's enduring curiosity about the cosmos. Draper's work laid the foundation for astrophotography, a field that continues to reveal the wonders of the universe. On March the 24th in 1882, Robert Koch's discovery of the tuberculosis bacterium was a monumental achievement in medical science. At the time, tuberculosis was a leading cause of death, and its origins were poorly understood. Koch developed a staining technique that allowed him to identify the bacterium, later named Mycobacterium tuberculosis, in the tissues of infected animals and humans. He also succeeded in isolating and growing the bacterium in pure culture, which was a significant challenge. By inoculating animals with the cultured bacteria, Koch demonstrated that it caused tuberculosis, thereby proving its role as the disease's agent. This work not only confirmed the germ theory of disease, but also laid the foundation for modern bacteriology. Koch's meticulous methods and his ability to link specific microorganisms to specific diseases earned him the Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine in 1905. His discoveries have saved countless lives and continue to influence public health and medical research. The Slave Trade Act of 1807, passed on the 25th of March in 1807, was a landmark moment in British history. This act abolished the transatlantic slave trade within the British Empire, making it illegal to engage in the buying and selling of enslaved people. However, it did not immediately emancipate those already enslaved, as slavery itself remained legal until the Slavery Abolition Act of 1833. The abolition was the result of decades of tireless campaigning by abolitionists like William Wilberforce, Thomas Clarkson, and the Quakers. They gathered evidence, lobbied Parliament, and raised public awareness about the inhumanity of the trade. Wilberforce, in particular, championed the cause in Parliament, presenting bills year after year until success was achieved. This achievement is remembered as a significant step toward human rights and justice, though it also serves as a reminder of the atrocities that necessitated such action. On March the 26th in 1953, the American toy company Wham-O was founded. Wham-O would go on to create some of the most iconic and joy-filled toys of the 20th century, including the Frisbee, the Hula Hoop, and the Slip and Slide. These toys brought countless hours of laughter and fun to children and to adults around the world. Henry Harvey's patent of the modern shoelace with the eaglet on March the 27th, 1790, was a deceptively simple invention that had a significant impact. Before this, shoes were often secured with buckles or other methods that were less practical and less customizable. Kennedy's design improved functionality and also brought a sense of elegance to footwear. The eaglet itself, that tiny piece at the end of a lace, prevents fraying and makes threading through eyelets much easier. It's one of those ingenious details we hardly notice, yet it quietly improves our daily lives. Eaglets have even found their way into popular culture, with references in TV shows and cartoons that playfully highlight their importance. March the 28th in 2007 marked the start of Earth Hour, a global movement organised by the Worldwide Fund for Nature to raise awareness about climate change and environmental conservation. It began in Sydney, Australia, as a symbolic lights-off event, where individuals, businesses and landmarks turned off non-essential lights for 1 hour. The event takes place annually, typically on the last Saturday of March, from 8:30 p.m. to 9:30 p.m. local time. Over the years, Earth Hour has grown into a worldwide phenomenon with millions of participants across more than 190 countries. Iconic landmarks like the Eiffel Tower, the Sydney Opera House and the Empire State Building have gone dark to show solidarity. Beyond the symbolic gesture, Earth Hour encourages people to take meaningful actions for the planet, such as reducing energy consumption, supporting renewable energy, and advocating for sustainable practices. It's a powerful reminder of how small collective actions can make a big difference for our planet. On the 29th of March in 1848, Niagara Falls experienced an extraordinary event. It stopped flowing for about 30 hours. This rare phenomenon occurred due to a massive ice jam at the mouth of the Niagara River, where it connects to Lake Erie. A strong southwest gale had pushed large ice fields into the river, creating a natural dam that completely blocked the water flow. The silence was eerie for locals who were accustomed to the thunderous roar of the falls. Some even feared it was a sign of impending disaster. However, once the cause was identified, curiosity replaced fear. Thousands of people flocked to the area to witness the exposed riverbed and cliffs. Adventurous visitors even ventured down to the riverbed, collecting souvenirs like old weapons and artifacts from the War of 1812. By March the 31st, the winds shifted, the ice dam broke, and the water resumed its majestic flow. To prevent such an event from happening again, an ice boom is now installed annually at the river's mouth to manage ice movement.
Hello, I'm Sue, and here are some famous people's birthdays that have taken place during this week over the years. 23rd of March, 1929, was the birthday of the English neurologist and middle distance runner, Roger Bannister. He won a scholarship to study medicine at Oxford, later rising to become one of the country's leading neurologists. In 1954, whilst at university, he achieved a world record in running a mile in less than 4 minutes. The Daily Telegraph, at the time, described the sub-4-minute mile as sport's greatest goal. Alan Sugar was born on the 24th of March, 1947, in Hackney. He left school at the age of 16 and began selling car radio aerials from the back of a van he had purchased for £50. In 1968, he founded a company specialising in consumer electronics, AMS Trading, later shortened to Amstrad. Today, as Baron Sugar of Clapton, he is a multimillionaire and has a reputation for being a formidable business magnate. The singer-songwriter and pianist Aretha Franklin was born in Memphis on the 25th of March, 1942. Her formative years were influenced by gospel singing in church. By the 1960s, she had become a respected rhythm and blues soul singer, but was also a significant contributor to the civil rights movement. Among her hit records are A Natural Woman, 1967, and I Say a Little Prayer, 1968. On the 26th of March, 1940, Nancy Pelosi, the first and only female speaker of the US House of Representatives, was born in Baltimore. Significant legislation passed during her tenure as speaker includes the 2009 American Recovery and Reinvestment Act and the 2010 Affordable Care Act, both signed into law by President Barack Obama. Nancy Pelosi currently represents the Democratic Party in California's 11th Congressional District. 27th of March, 1969, is the birthday of the American singer-songwriter Mariah Carey. Her debut album of 1990, Mariah Carey, reached number one in the same year. Her voice is renowned for its remarkable range, flexibility, and melismatic style, in which several notes are sung to one syllable. Since its release in 1994, her most successful song,
All I Want for Christmas is You, has been streamed over 2 billion times. On the 28th of March, 1935, near Barnsley, the television presenter, broadcaster, journalist and author Sir Michael Parkinson was born. After working on local newspapers, he was employed on the Manchester Guardian and the Daily Express, moving into television in the 1960s. His crowning achievement is his television chat show, launched initially on the BBC, which ran for over 800 episodes. The English sea captain and social campaigner, Thomas Coram, was born in Lyme Regis on the 29th of March, 1668. He was shocked by the desperate plight of young children, many of whom were living on the streets, and in 1739 he established the Foundling Hospital in London's Bloomsbury as a home for babies whose mothers were unable to care for them. Early supporters of Coram's campaign included the composer George Friedrich Handel and the artist William Hogarth.
Thank you, Sue, and now I'll hand you over to David Arison to tell you about Glenn Miller, the man and his music.
David Arison here again with another blast from the past, this time the unique sound of Glenn Miller and his orchestra. In the Mood, which we have just heard, being one of his best known and immediately recognisable numbers. Glenn Miller was a big band trombonist, arranger, composer and band leader in the swing era, and the number of hits that he produced made his disappearance in 1944 all the more of a tragedy. It's amazing to think that between 1939 and 1942, he had 16 number one records and 69 top 10 hits, more than Elvis Presley and the Beatles did in their careers. He was born in 1904 in Iowa, and when he was nine, his family moved to Grant City, Missouri. While still at school, he earned enough money from milking cows to buy his first trombone, and he joined the town band. During his senior year at high school, he became interested in dance band music and dropped out of college to pursue a career as a professional musician. He played in Ben Pollock's band as a trombone soloist, but when Jack Teagarden joined the band, he found that his opportunities as a player were diminishing, and so he realised that his future lay in arranging and composing. In 1928, when the Pollock Band went to New York, he asked his college sweetheart, Helen Berger, to join him, and they were married. He made several arrangements for Pollock's band, but his first composition was Room 1411, which he recorded with Benny Goodman's Boys with Brunswick Records. He was a great friend of Benny Goodman, and when Ben Pollock's band eventually broke up, they lived together in an apartment block in New York. Life was tough for musicians at this time, and apparently they would get up early and borrow empty milk bottles from other apartments and cash them in at the local grocery store so that they could buy hot dogs for lunch. He did manage to get published Glenn Miller's 125 Jazz Breaks for Trombone in Chicago. During the late 20s and early 30s, he worked as a freelance trombonist and played in the pit with Benny Goodman and the drummer Gene Krupa for two Broadway shows, Girl Crazy and Strike Up the Band. In the 30s, he worked for the Dorsey Brothers Band. In 1935, he assembled an American orchestra for the British band leader Ray Noble and developed a lineup of a lead clarinet over four saxophones, the sound that became a characteristic of his own big band. He also made his first movie appearance in the Ray Noble Orchestra, performing Why Stars Come Out at Night. Time for another piece. Here is String of Pearls, which he recorded in November 1941. In 1937, he formed his own band and arranged music for it, but after a stint in the Ritz Ballroom at Connecticut, the orchestra disbanded, having failed to stand out from the many other bands at the time. Somewhat dejected, he went back to New York and decided that he needed to create a unique sound. He used the clarinet to play the tune with a tenor sax and had three other saxes all harmonising. He even hired a saxophonist called Wilbur Schwartz, but asked him to play the clarinet. This sound combination worked so well that the Glenn Miller sound that we know today made his band distinctive and successful. The band's popularity grew and culminated in an appearance in 1939 at Carnegie Hall with Paul Whiteman and Benny Goodman. In 1940, the band's version of Tuxedo Junction sold 115,000 copies in the first week of its release. From December 1939 to September 1942, the band was heard on CBS radio three times a week, and in 1942 was presented with its first golden disc for Chattanooga Choo Choo. Here is the version he recorded in May 1941.
Aside, partner, it's my day. Bend an ear and listen to my version
of a really solid Tennessee excursion.
Partner, pardon me, boy, is that the Chattanooga juju?
Yes, yes, track 29.
Boy, you can give me a shine.
Can you afford to board Chattanooga choo-choo?
I got my fare
and just a trifle to spare.
You leave the Pennsylvania station about a quarter to four, read a magazine and then you're in Baltimore.
Dinner in the diner, nothing could be finer
than to have your ham and eggs in Carolina.
When you hear the whistle blowing eight to the bar, then you know that Tennessee is not very far.
Shamel all the coal in, gotta keep it rolling.
Ooh, ooh, Chattanooga, there you are.
There's gonna be a certain party at the station.
Satin and lace.
I used to call Funny Face. She's gonna cry until I tell her that I'll never roam.
So Chattanooga choo-choo,
won't you choo-choo me home?
Chattanooga, Chattanooga,
get aboard.
Chattanooga, Chattanooga,
all aboard.
Chattanooga, Chattanooga.
In 1942, the peak of his civilian career, Glenn Miller decided to join the war effort. He was too old to be drafted and so applied to join the Navy, but they rejected him. He then applied to the US Army and persuaded them that he could run a successful army band. His patriotism in wanting to help, and probably his fame, earned him the rank of captain, and he was later promoted to major in 1944. He was quickly transferred to the Army Air Forces. He formed a large marching band that was to be the core of a network of service orchestras, but his attempts to modernise met with some resistance from the more traditional elements. However, he did get permission to form a 50-piece Army Air Force band, which he took to England in the summer of 1944. He and the band had their headquarters in London in a BBC office, but when a bomb fell close by, they moved to Bedford. This proved to be a good move, as the day after he moved out, the office he had been using in London was destroyed by a V-1 flying bomb. During his time in this country, he gave over 800 performances and recorded at Abbey Road Studios. The results of these sessions were used as propaganda by the Office of War Information. In December 1944, there were plans to move his operation and base it in Paris. To begin planning this, he flew over the English Channel to France, but the plane in which he was flying disappeared in bad weather over the English Channel. He left behind a wife and two adopted children. He was posthumously awarded the Bronze Star, and this was presented to his widow Helen in March 1945. After his death, which wasn't announced until over a week later, the Air Force Band was decommissioned and sent back to the United States. The story did not stop there, however, and there were several reincarnations of the Glenn Miller Band. Today, most branches of the American military, as well as marching and concert bands, have jazz orchestras and groups playing all sorts of music, and this is all down to the legacy of Glenn Miller. The Glenn Miller Story, a film about his life and music, was made in 1953. The tracks we have played today were all recorded in the 30s and 40s, so you've definitely heard the genuine article. I hope you've enjoyed the short taste of the sound of one of the greatest dance band orchestras that there has ever been, and a glimpse into the life of its creator, the immortal Glenn Miller. Let's finish with Moonlight Serenade, perhaps the most sentimental, but without doubt one of the pieces that is the unmistakable sound of the Glenn Miller Orchestra. Thank you.
Hi, it's Clive Davis from the Wildlife Sound Recording Society. I was at my allotment the other morning and saw that the frogs had returned to the ponds. So I thought that amphibians should be the theme of this month's sound recordings. The first recording that you'll hear are common toads that I recorded on a pond on Cannock Chase, which is quite close to my home address. Then it's off to my allotment for the sound of the common frogs. I occasionally use hydrophones, which give an amazing insight into the soundscape underwater, something that we hardly, if ever, hear. This recording is again at the allotment pond and is of the common frogs calling under the water. Several years ago on holiday in Spain, as we walked along a footpath next to a dry riverbed, I realised that I could hear frogs calling. I went back later and fought my way through the undergrowth to find a tiny pond that hadn't dried up. I left my equipment out throughout the night. You only have to listen to a few minutes. I had nearly 12 hours of recordings. You are very lucky. These are the calls of the marsh frogs. In the background, you will notice that there is a tawny owl calling. As dawn broke, the birds started to vocalise as the frogs' calls diminished. Here you will hear moorhen, golden oriole, blackcap, nightingale and wood pigeon.
Hello, I'm Terry, and this article is entitled The Empress and the Doctor. 150 years ago, Hartford's Thomas Dimmesdale received a request from Catherine the Great to bring his cure for the devastating smallpox to Russia. The man calling at the consulting room of the eminent Hertfordshire physician Thomas Dimmesdale on an April morning in 1768 seemed out of place in the village of Benjo. His flamboyant appearance and long beard marked him out as a foreigner, which indeed he was, for he was a special envoy from the royal court of Tsarina, come to persuade the doctor to travel to St. Petersburg to attend on Empress Catherine the Great of Russia. Thomas Dimmesdale was no ordinary physician. He was renowned for his method of variolation, immunising a patient against smallpox, variola, by deliberately infecting them with fluid from smallpox scabs taken from a patient with a mild form of the disease. The resulting smallpox infection then occurred less dangerously than if contracted by natural means. Dimmesdale was not the pioneer of this technique. He had copied and improved on a similar procedure by Robert Sutton in Essex, who, despite lack of medical qualifications, had achieved great success in inoculating patients. After studying Sutton's methods, it was Dimmesdale's treatise, The Present Method for Inoculating for the Smallpox, published in 1767, that spread the knowledge in medical circles, earning him acclaim as far as Russia. The Russian ambassador to England had taken news of Dimmesdale's successful procedure to the Russian capital, St. Petersburg, and to Russia's ruler, the Tsarina. The rapidly developing, highly infectious disease, characterised by fluid-filled bumps all over the body, occurred in devastating outbreaks, killing around a third of those who contracted it. Soon after she became empress in 1762, Catherine had been shocked by the horrible death from smallpox of her foreign minister's fiancé, Countess Sheremetov. Moreover, the disfiguring effects on her husband, Peter III, whose appearance she described as quite hideous, and the death of 20,000 of her subjects to the disease in 1 year, brought home the horror of this killer. Catherine was desperate to have herself and her son, the Grand Duke Paul, as well as her subjects, inoculated against the disease and was prepared to act as guinea pig. Dimmesdale was an independently wealthy, respected 56-year-old physician and a man driven by his Quaker faith. Yet, despite the honour of attending on perhaps the most powerful woman in the world, Dimmesdale was not inclined to say yes. And it took a second envoy in July 1768 and payment of £1,000 to convince him to undertake the hazardous 2,000-mile journey to St. Petersburg. On July the 28th, 1768, accompanied by his son, a medical student at Edinburgh University, they set off for Russia. After a month travelling via Amsterdam, Danzig and Riga, they arrived in the Russian capital and, to their shock, were placed under what appeared to be house arrest in a large mansion close to the royal palace. Dimmesdale was visited by the foreign minister, Count Panin, who greeted his guests with a veiled threat. "Should an accident deprive us of either the Tsarina or her son, the blessings we now bestow might be exchanged for the utmost state of misery." Given his initial reluctance to accept the mission, Panin's welcome must have caused the physician to reflect on the enormity of what lay ahead. On his fourth day in the capital, Dimmesdale was summoned to a private audience with Catherine at her summer palace at Pushkin, south of the city. The meeting went well, and Dimmesdale was beguiled by her, calling her most engaging. He discussed the process of inoculation, and the Empress responded by asking intelligent and penetrating questions. Dimmesdale suggested to the Tsarina that she allow her own physicians to assist him, and perhaps to take a share of the blame should anything go wrong. But she refused. "My life belongs to me," she said, "and I have great pleasure in entrusting it entirely to you." Despite his anxiety, Dimmesdale bowed to Tsarina and promised obedience. In the late evening of October 12, 1768, Dimmesdale was summoned to the Winter Palace in St. Petersburg. He had earlier inoculated a young peasant boy, Alexander Markov, with the smallpox virus to provide a fresh sample for the Tsarina's procedure. In great secrecy, he was escorted to the Empress's bedroom. He made a tiny incision in each of Catherine's arms and placed in each cut a scraping of smallpox fluid taken from the peasant boy's scabs. The next morning, the Tsarina departed for the summer palace, where Dimmesdale supervised her convalescence. A few days after her arrival, she developed a fever and pains in her body, and smallpox pustules began to emerge on parts of her body. Dimmesdale noted in his journal that the Tsarina had provided him and his son with passports and a coach with fast horses standing by, just in case things went wrong. He may or may not have known that a previous Tsar, Ivan III, had executed two German physicians whose royal patients had died. None of the precautions were necessary. By the end of the month, Catherine had recovered and returned to St. Petersburg. On November 2nd, Dimmesdale inoculated the 14-year-old Grand Duke, who also made a complete recovery. When news of his success became public knowledge at the Russian court, the nobility rushed to copy the Tsarina's example. In the next few months, the height of the freezing Russian winter, Dimmesdale inoculated more than 200 nobles and royal officials in St. Petersburg and Moscow, all of whom recovered. Dimmesdale instructed Russian physicians on his techniques and established inoculation hospitals in both cities. Gold medals were struck by the Russian mint to commemorate the royal inoculations, bearing the inscription, "She saved others to the danger of herself." The young peasant from whose arm the smallpox virus had been taken was made a noble for his role in the procedure. Even as Dimmesdale was teaching Russian physicians, however, the new epidemic was tearing through the Russian countryside. The gratitude of Catherine for Dimmesdale's work was deep. She made him a Baron of the Russian Empire and awarded him £12,000 and a pension of £500 per annum for life. He was also presented with diamond-encrusted portraits of herself and her son and was made a royal counsellor. One grateful Russian nobleman presented Dimmesdale with a bag of gold, which the doctor found too heavy to carry. In all, he was paid today's equivalent of £10 million for his work in Russia. The gifts lavished on Dimmesdale show not just how grateful the Russian court was, but also how much they feared the deadly effects of smallpox. Baron Dimmesdale returned home to Hartford in 1769 to continue his medical practice in the town. He would return to Russia one final time in 1782 to inoculate the Grand Duke's two sons, Alexander and Constantine. At home, Dimmesdale was made a Fellow of the Royal Society and stood successfully for Parliament in 1780 and 1784. He invested his wealth in a private bank, but soon formed his own Bank of Staples, Baron Dimmesdale and Son, in London. Although he had consulting rooms in Hartford, Dimmesdale's home was a short distance away at Port Hill House in Benjo, which the locals called the Inoculation House. Joining his property in 1763, he built an isolation hospital on the corner of Bide Street and Fanshawe Street to isolate patients from the community until they had recovered from the inoculation. It is still called the Old Pest House, a reference to a time when smallpox was known as the pestilence. By the time of his death, aged 88, in December 1800, medical science had improved on his work, and Dimmesdale found his technique of variolation superseded by Edward Jenner's 1796 process of vaccination, a process that took samples of a similar but less deadly disease from a cow, the Latin root vaccinus means of a cow, after he observed milkmaids who contracted cowpox did not later catch smallpox. Dimmesdale is buried with family in the Quakers' burial ground in Bishop Stortford. In St Andrew's Church in Hartford, a simple marble plaque honours this leading figure of 18th century science, who could be called the world's first biotech entrepreneur. His work in the field of immunisation played a key part in the final global eradication in 1980 of one of the biggest killers in human history. And the article is accompanied by a picture of a very impressive-looking Catherine the Great of Russia.
We're nearing the end of this week's programme. It just remains for me to thank our contributors, Lucy, Ian, Hilary and Gilly, for reading the news, The Heart's Advertiser for providing it. Thanks to John for the radio listings, our friends at Wharfdale Talking News for the audio-described TV listings, TNF Soundings for 10 Today, and Clive Davis of the Wildlife Sound Recording Society for the evocative recordings of amphibians. David read the events in history, and Sue presented famous birthdays. The Heart's Life Story was read by Terry. Steve will be here next week with News Extra, but that's all from me in March 2025. We close with Glenn Miller's great Moonlight Serenade, which I'm sure my parents danced to in Cairo in 1945. I hope you enjoy it. And remember to let us know about music you'd like to hear on our programmes. Goodbye for now, and keep well.